Hi, Mark.
Hey, Megan, how are you?
Well, I've been better. The markets are a little difficult today.
Yes, I might have guessed that.
Little worried about the fate of my retirement fund.
Well, you're young enough.
Yes, and appropriately diversified, we hope.
Appropriately diversified would be entirely in German government bonds, right?
No, canned goods and ammunition.
Oh, canned goods and ammunition. I'd forgotten that. I'd forgotten that. Well, happy St. Patrick's Day.
Thank you very much, and the same to you.
I decided not to wear either green or orange.
I'm appropriately decked out in black, signifying
Yes.
the death of the credit market's dreams for a quick recovery.
All right. Right.
So
So
I've
where do you see us going from here?
God, we got a lot to talk about today, right? Well, I mean, starting off, I think I'm not going to make a prediction about what's going to happen. I was reading over some of my old blog posts today, and I think the best one I ever wrote is possibly one where I said, "Well, I'll tell you what's going to happen tomorrow. The market's going to go up, or it's going to stay flat, or it will fall."
Right.
And that's about the position we're in right now. I think right now we're watching Lehman Brothers, and if they make it through the week, that'll be a really good sign for the credit markets. And if they experience the same kind of problems that Bear has had, I think we're probably in for some big trouble. But I don't know what's going to happen at this point.
So we could really be in a position now where people are doing classic 1928 bear raider stuff.
I think we could be
Mean
in
shorting
a
Lehman and
position
spreading the rumors,
where we're doing
right?
classic 1930 drastic credit market contraction.
Well, that too.
Which would certainly be bad news for the rest of us.
Right.
Which is the I guess the first topic of conversation is the bailout and what we should do about financial regulation. I think you have some strong opinions on this.
Well, some strong questions, right? So it seems to me in the argument that the Fed bailout has moral hazard with respect to the behavior of firms like Bear Stearns isn't all that strong. After all, they, at least their shareholders took a big haircut, and apparently a third of the shares were owned by the employees.
Yeah, I think
So.
the employees are mostly going to lose their jobs, and the shareholders are basically hosed by this. They're in a. I didn't realize this last night, but certainly this morning, as I took a closer look at their balance sheet and read some of the stories on it, it became clear that the Bear Stearns shareholders are going to do worse out of this than they probably would in a bankruptcy, unless, of course, the bankruptcy caused just a massive panic in the markets, which is quite possible. But yeah, this is Paul Krugman wrote an op-ed. I think for today, about what should happen, whether there should be a bailout, and I think he has it about right, which is that the government is going to have to bail out certain kinds of institutions that fail, but it should really hurt. It shouldn't be the bankers should not escape unscathed. They should suffer greatly pour encourager les autres, as it
Right.
were.
Well, that, but it's not just the bankers, right? I mean, somebody pointed out, maybe it was you, that who really got bailed out when the Fed lent the money to Morgan to lend it to the bear. The people who got bailed out were the counterparties in all
Yes.
those transactions. Well, so they're the ones who are getting bailed out. It looks to me like they're not taking any haircut at all.
Well, at this point, no, they're not. But it's not clear that they should. I mean, a lot of this counterparty stuff you have to remember is, basically these guys are, they're doing trades. I mean, they suffered from both sides, right? A lot of this is just that the hedge funds took their deposits out, which they're perfectly entitled to do. And I also think it's really not clear that counterparties weren't doing due diligence. I mean, basically, Bear Stearns' balance sheet may be okay. JP Morgan is almost certainly going to end up making a lot of money out of this deal, and the Fed is probably not going to lose by it, in my opinion.
Right.
I think probably JP Morgan will end up, re that a lot of the paper will end up sort of covering itself, and JP Morgan will end up redeeming some of it. But the counterparties went in, what we expect them to do due diligence is insofar as they can, but all of these companies are black boxes, right? And the other thing is that there's a collective part of this. Bear Stearns was fine until all of the repo guys started refusing to lend, and all of the hedge funds started pulling their money out. And
Mm-hmm.
so at any given point, right, it wasn't a bad idea to have a deposit with them until everyone else started getting spooked too. Now that I don't think we know yet. I think we'll know more as JP Morgan starts to unwind all of this stuff. Bear Stearns is claiming that they've got a book value of about $84 a share. And so it's not clear how much
They're claiming
you can
they have a
expect
book
them
value
to
of,
do.
they're claiming they have a book value of 84, and they just sold out for 2. Looks to me like there's a massive shareholder suit here.
There probably will be, almost certainly. But I,
And so why
and
was
I,
the CEO did it just to stand tall on Wall Street?
well, they did it because if Bear Stearns just stops being the counterparty to these trades, it's not clear. The basic fear is that credit markets will just lock up. That
Right.
that this allows that with JP Morgan basically has sort of the biggest balance sheet of the four remaining bulge bracket firms on Wall Street. And because they're attached to a gigantic commercial bank, which is sort of in some ways safer than investment banks right now. And so there's no fear that JP Morgan can't cover the counterparty risk, basically.
Right.
Sure, JP Morgan's going to make money, but they're making money by taking on counterparty risk. And also, I think, you know, this is basically about the shareholders sort of being told, you had better do this because don't screw with the Fed. And also that it's not clear what the shareholders will get out if just the markets sort of panic and everything locks up. If the bankruptcy court has to sell into a
Right.
real liquidity crisis, even worse than the one that we have now, they might end up with nothing. So probably $2 a share, given the uncertainty about the future of the credit markets, it's a little unfair. I mean, it definitely represents a huge amount of clearly negotiating power on the part of the Fed and JP Morgan, but I can't say that I'm terrifically sympathetic to the Bear Stearns shareholders. You know, you invest in a company, you take your lumps if it fails.
Well, but you expect the management of the company to be working for you and not the Fed. I mean, I don't know this stuff, but what I hear you saying to me is, look, in a bankruptcy, the Bear Stearns shareholders might have gotten $10 a share of their $84 book value instead of $2 a share. But there would have been huge losses elsewhere in the economy. And the Fed and Morgan and the CEO of Bear Stearns decided, no, we're not going to do that. We're just going to give this company to J.P. Morgan, which, as a citizen and holder of other securities, I'm happy to hear. But it seems like a pretty huge lapse in fiduciary duty on the part of the CEO, the management of Bear Stearns. I sort of want to know what their inducement to do that was.
Well, for starters,
I mean,
you have to remember
running
that
this outfit
33% of the about a third of the owners are employees, and some
right.
of them will salvage their jobs by doing this. If there was a bankruptcy, they would all lose their jobs. So they have an incentive to vote for this because this gives them about a 1 in 2, 1 in 3 chance of keeping a job with J.P. Morgan.
Is there a vote to come up by the shareholders?
What?
The
vote's going to come up in front of the shareholders. The next, yeah, no, you can't sell a company without, the shareholders have to vote yes on this. The next question is, should they have negotiated harder? Yes and no, right? They had a hard deadline, which makes it hard for management, and JP Morgan was holding all the cards. It's pretty hard to negotiate in that
right.
situation.
Well, is there a walkaway clause, or can somebody else come in now? Can Warren Buffett come in tomorrow and say, okay, $3?
Well, no one else. The problem is, right, Warren Buffett doesn't have the balance sheet to do that. His money is tied up in companies. There aren't a lot of companies that actually have the ability to manage this. You could get a foreign
mm-hmm.
buyer, right, but there aren't, you know, and I believe KKR was sort of there and then pulled out and decided
mm-hmm.
Not to compete with JP Morgan for this, precisely because KKR doesn't have the kind of balance sheet. Because no one understands, these things are a black box. Just no one understands at this point.
Right.
No one had time to understand what
right.
the counterparty risk is.
Right. Which then raises the question about whether we need some sort of regulatory device to make them less of a black box. I mean, if the Fed is going to wind up, in effect, insuring all these counterparties, then can we really have what are essentially unregulated transactions, right? Commercial banks are regulated up the wazoo because, after all, the bank insurers are standing behind them.
I think that this is a real question. I mean, I think that for starters, one thing we probably do need and don't really have right now. The FDIC, basically, when there's a bank run, when a bank basically becomes insolvent because, either because it's financially shaky and it really is insolvent, or just because there's a run on the bank, the FDIC is really, really good at unwinding that. They're
Right.
really like, there's an orderly procedure for doing this, and everyone understands how it's going to happen, and it's fast, and it reassures the market so that
Right.
these things
And
don't spend
the
out.
FDIC knows all about the bank because it gets inspected every 3 months.
So in that sense, we definitely need a better mechanism, clearly, for unwinding financial firms that aren't banks. The second question is, what kind of prospective regulation do we want? I mean, these guys are actually really quite heavily regulated. The problem isn't that it's not a black box because they don't report to the SEC and the Federal Reserve what they're doing. It's a black box because no one knows what these things are worth. Right? Everyone has their risk pricing model, and the whole point, that's how they compete, is on their risk pricing model. And there's just, the commercial banks do something we understand really well. Even then, they took baths, right? I mean, they were even more heavily regulated in the 70s, and they still ended up getting completely hosed in Latin America. The fact is, you can be overtaken by events even when you're extremely careful.
Yeah, when people were telling me about these risk pricing models, and I don't have enough math to really do fancy finance,
Nor I.
but it always seemed to me that this was assuming that there was no black swan, right? We're going to use the last 10 years of variance to estimate the variance.
I think
Well, that
Nassim
can't be
Taleb
right.
is got to be dancing on. I mean, he's got to be fielding phone calls from every journalist. He looks great today. Because this is exactly
Who?
what he was talking about. This is exactly what he was talking about with people underpricing the risk of catastrophic events. And I
Sorry,
agree. I
who was
think
saying that?
that that happened.
Sorry, who was saying that?
This guy Nassim Taleb, he's I'm not sure I'm pronouncing his name exactly right. He's written two books, the latest of which was called The Black Swan. And basically his argument is that people are dramatically underestimating the likelihood of extremely unlikely events. They're basically they're making the tails too narrow. And the problem with that is that you can then get these situations where, for example, one of the things that has been happening in the credit markets, right, is things that are normally re negatively inversely correlated, so that when one goes up, the other one goes down. They all started moving together, and that caused that's why the StatArb guys, a lot of their hedge funds blew up. And so what he's saying is that they underestimate the possibility that that's going to happen. And I think he's probably right. I mean, I think that this is a real, and I thought I it sounded plausible to me when I heard it, but the problem with regulation is, and I'm not a super anti-regulationist. I'm very much about transparency, but the real problem is that the regulators aren't smarter than the people that they regulate, right? And there's you can set up a regulator that's extremely conservative, and in some way, that will prevent things like this from happening, but it will also prevent a lot of other things that we want to happen from happening. And it's not clear to me what kind of regulation you could enact that would have stopped this and would not have caused sort of damage in other sectors of the economy and stopped a lot of good things from happening. It's really, really tough.
Well, that doesn't it all, in some sense, go back to the appraisers working for the mortgage brokers doing bum appraisals that led to people lending money on houses that weren't worth it?
Even then, I think I love, I don't particularly care for John Kenneth Galbraith as an economist, but as an economic historian, he's brilliant. And I highly recommend to everyone his book on the stock market crash of 1929, and also his book on financial bubbles. I think it's extraordinarily difficult. I mean, there was some of that. There was clearly fraud. And you have to also say the lenders. There were borrowers who committed fraud. There were mortgage brokers who were clearly committing fraud, both on borrowers and on the people that they were, selling, getting the loans, the lenders that they were working for. There were certainly appraisers who were crooked and were hired by crooked borrowers and crooked mortgage brokers. But you have to remember, people were appraising stuff as being worth more than it was because the market was appreciating really rapidly. And
And also because the banks that were making the loans were selling them right away, right? So they weren't taking the risk.
It wasn't just that. It was, and I blogged about this today. I had a conversation about 2 years ago, I think, with this guy who had gone to Chicago. He graduated in '99, so he graduated right before I got there. And he worked for an investment bank at the time. The funny thing is, he's now not in investment banking. He's like selling. He has like a taco stand in Hoboken.
Well, I mean, there's probably less risk.
No, but I mean, he's like, it's an entrepreneurial thing. He wanted to do sort of high-end lunches that people would buy and take into Wall Street. He was just sick of Wall Street.
Right.
And I have no idea
Well, I
how
mean,
he's
see,
doing now, but
it's the old rule, right? You want to make money in a gold rush.
exactly.
Sell
And
mining
maybe that.
equipment.
That, yeah, so that's what he's doing. He's selling maybe now he's selling sort of like sleeping pills in large quantities.
Right.
But at any rate, he said to me, "Well, we just in the last 10 years we've gotten so much better at pricing credit risk," and that's sort of always because I've always been an avid follower of financial bubbles, and this was before I went to business school. Basically ever since I read John Kenneth Galbraith's book when I was in college, I think, and that just sort of put the hairs on the back of my neck on end, and I said,
Right.
"Are we really better at pricing credit risk, or do we just think we're better at pricing credit risk?" And he said,
When
"No,
did he say
we're
this?
better." And I think we did get some. We got better at pricing credit risk. In
Right.
fact, they were right, but we didn't get as much better as we thought we got.
Right.
And the thing is that people are looking for like a criminal here, and the fact is there weren't really that many criminals. There were just a lot of people, all of whom were sort of taken in by the fact that there was a lot of easy money around, and a huge amount of speculative fever. They were taken in by that, and they thought that sort of the laws of supply and demand had been repealed.
Well, but also there was moral hazard operating at a completely different level, which is that what was it the was the CEO of Citigroup who said, "Yeah, the music's going to stop sometime, but while it's playing, we're going to dance,"
Well, I
and
think,
he walked
yeah.
away with hundreds of millions of dollars from having cost his shareholders billions of dollars because all these incentive contracts mean that people are gambling with other people's money,
I think that's a problem. I mean,
right?
this is a problem of it's a principal agent problem. It's a problem
Right.
of CEO pay in general. But I do
And
want to
it's why
actually.
John Stuart Mill believed that the joint stock company was the lead to socialism.
I mean, I do want to actually defend the bankers a little bit more. Not from like I think they should suffer, right? I think if this they should pay for having been incredibly stupid,
Well, but
and
again,
I'm not sure they're going
it's
to
not the
suffer
bankers who are
enough.
going to pay, it's their shareholders who are going to pay.
Oh, the bankers are going to pay too. I mean, most of the people who are really stupid are going to end up losing their jobs. A lot of them already have lost their jobs in the hedge funds. And when you're, it sounds like you laugh all the way to the bank, but in fact, when you're a hedge fund manager or whatever, a lot of them will have lost all of their money, because remember, most of their wealth usually ends up tied up in their firm, certainly at the hedge fund level, not so much at the Citigroup level. But
Right.
losing your job is traumatic for anyone. Like it is something that
Right.
anyone wants to avoid.
Right.
So forget the moral implications of how much money they make or whatever. But I think that the object lesson is there. If they lose their jobs, if they, but I think that it's sort of easy in hindsight to say, well, we should have done this, we should have done that. But when you're in the middle of a bubble, one of the problems, right, is that the market can stay foolish longer than you can stay insolvent.
Right.
And these banks didn't have as much of a choice as it looks like they did. If they hadn't, right, if these guys hadn't invested in a market that was going up and up and up and up and up. Their shareholders would have fired them and put someone else in because they would have been in charge of a bank that was, sort of stagnant or losing money while
Well,
everyone else was raking it in.
but Morgan didn't, right?
And the mortgage-backed security thing, you have to realize the banks bought them back, right? They packaged them and sold them, but then in a lot of cases, their portfolios and other segments of the bank were buying them. So I don't think it's, and this is the Bear Stearns story, right? I don't think it's a
Not necessarily their
problem of.
own, right?
They
So they
didn't necessarily buy their own, right? But they weren't trying to commit a fraud. They thought that these, they sold the risk because people thought that diversifying risk was a good thing. They
well,
sold
but
some
careful.
risk, they bought others. They did have some of their own bonds in their portfolios. They took, remember, when these guys issue securities, if they can't sell them, they eat them. And there
Right.
was a whole, it's really easy to suspect that they must have just been putting one over on us. And I'm sure that there were some people who thought that they were. But in most cases, it really is just that they thought that they had repealed the law of averages,
Well,
and they hadn't.
but also, wait. I mean, it's true they wound up, buying the same garbage they were selling from somebody else. But it's also true that they had no particular incentive to make the garbage they were selling smell any sweeter than anybody else's garbage. I mean, there was a failure of the incentive system here that sort of went many levels up and down.
I think
Right?
I still think that you're thinking that they knew that it was garbage, and I really don't think that they did.
No, it's not that,
I
not that
mean,
they
right,
knew.
like
They had no incentive to make sure it wasn't garbage. Right? Because look, they could sell it, right? They knew what its value was. Its value is what they could sell it for. And it
right,
didn't
but they
really
didn't
much
have any better
matter.
information than the buyers about whether certainly at the Bear Stearns level, they didn't have better information than the buyers did.
All I'm saying is they didn't have as much incentive as we would have liked them to have to get better information. Right? You know the story about the can of sardines, which trades around and at a higher and higher in price, and finally somebody opens it up, and they're bad. And he goes back to the original seller and says, "Look, the sardines are bad." And the guy says, "No, look, those weren't eating sardines; those were selling sardines."
I think that I think there's a bigger question, which is about the way that this supply chain. We had a theory about credit markets, and about the ways in which you could diversify risks, and the thought that diversifying risks, right, repackaging these mortgages into a bunch of different securities, actually isn't a bad idea, sort of in theory. It diversifies. I would say it's
It's a great
actually
idea.
it's not a bad idea in practice either. The problem was as it got more and more complex, no one was sort of capable of tracking what the risks were, and it became really, really difficult to untangle where the risk was coming from. And I think people who are talking about the Fed should buy the mortgages. At this point, the question is from who? It's so convoluted that I'm not even sure that works. Are you going to pay
Well,
off all of these
the other thing
securities
that
and you
seems to me, I mean, tell me if this is wrong, that's really at the base of this, is that in 2001 and for the next 3 years, the Fed decided to put the economy on methamphetamine to wake it up.
I actually
And
don't buy that theory. I my and I go back to my infatuation with John Kenneth Galbraith. But if you look at what happened in the 20s, right, the Fed increased the money supply somewhat. But that's not really enough to explain what was happening on Wall Street. What was happening on Wall Street was that rivers of gold were pouring in from abroad because of problems with the exchange rate, because people were maintaining the gold standard at sort of bad values for various currencies. And so all this money, for sort of long, boring reasons I won't go into, all of this foreign money was coming into Wall Street. And so when the Fed tried to intervene, the Fed actually in the 20s did try to pop the stock market bubble. It didn't do it until sort of late-ish in the process, but it did try to inflate it, and it raised interest rates really quite high for the era, especially in margin loans. The problem was that all that did was bring more money in because the margin loans were making so much money. And once the speculative boom is taken off, people don't care how much it costs them to borrow because they're going to make so much money. And that was what we
No, but
saw in the housing market as well, right? People
sorry,
didn't
I
care what
was
it cost them to borrow because, of course, they were going to make a huge amount of money on their rapidly appreciating house.
right, but the thing about
And what
but the
we saw
houses were
in this decade is, in my opinion, very much the same thing. There was a fantastic amount of capital flowing into the United States from abroad, particularly from Asia. And the Federal Reserve, I mean, the Federal Reserve, in fact, did sort of play around with short-term rates, and it just didn't do any good, because so much capital was pouring in from abroad that no one cared what the Fed was lending out short-term. So I think they had some role in it, but I actually think the role was pretty minor, and I think that the much larger piece that we have no control over was all these crazy people in Asia who decided for some reason that the United States was like the promised land, and you couldn't go wrong by buying dollar assets.
But they weren't buying houses.
Well, they were lending it, but it displaces, right? It's capital is fungible.
Right.
Whatever they happened to buy, that money
Right.
was pouring into the debt markets.
But it seems to me that part of the reason for the housing bubble was that when mortgages cost 4.5%, and inflation was 2%, so you're paying 2.5% real on your house, then the capital cost of your house was a trivial consideration. And people could systematically buy more houses than they could really afford. That started house prices soaring, and then everybody jumped on because house prices were soaring. But it seems to me the root of it was that money was so cheap that people were buying houses they couldn't really live in.
Well, I absolutely agree with that, but I think that the reason that what we're arguing about is, and it's you know, it's an iterative system, right? The house goes up, so it's more attractive to lend, et cetera. I just think that the real root of the problem of where the money was coming from was abroad, not here. And so even if the Fed had raised rates quite high, that might have just made America even more attractive place to lend money. It might not, and because houses were going up so fast, it's not clear to me that people would have stopped borrowing to buy more houses than they could afford.
So it seems to me if mortgage interest rates had gone up earlier, that would have slowed things down a lot.
The problem is, I think they would have had to go up so early that it wasn't possible to see at the time, right? To stop the bubble from taking off, I would say you would have had to get mortgage interest rates up by no later than very early 2003. And at that point, the economy was still kind of iffy.
Right.
And there was no bubble, right? You would have had to raise the interest rates before the speculative mania took off. Once the speculative mania gets rooted and it is obvious that it is a bubble,
right,
then it's too late. And this is actually the problem. This is the problem that I – or the question I ask about what financial regulations you're going to put in place.
You're being a little too generous to Greenspan there. Sorry. You're being a little too generous to Greenspan there. And he was urging people to buy houses on ARMs in 2004.
I would say – but he wasn't wrong. I mean, like you paid –
Well, sure he was wrong.
Well, no, he was wrong the way that people ended up doing it. He isn't wrong that you pay to get a fixed rate mortgage. In fact, like there's no economic advantage over the long term usually to getting a fixed rate mortgage because you have to pay extra to get that. You have to pay a higher average interest rate in order to fix it. You know, assuming that the lenders are moderately intelligent. He was wrong in the way that it turned out, right? People ended up using ARMs in these crazy ways, and lenders got ever more inventive. I don't think Greenspan was saying you should go get an option ARM where you can pay less than the interest rate in a month.
Well, but everybody in the world, presumably including Greenspan, knew that it was happening, and you know, there was never a hint that this was a problem. And part of the issue was that the option ARM in particular was designed, as far as I can tell, mostly to make it easier for people to qualify for mortgages, right? Because the qualification was somehow done on the first year's payment, which was insane. And I don't know whose rule that was. I don't know if that was a FDIC rule. I mean, I don't know who gets to decide who's qualified for a mortgage.
The bank. The bank decides whether they want to lend money to someone or not.
But that was, you know, I mean, the banks that were doing that should have been regarded as engaging in unsound lending practices, right? If you lend money to buy a house where he can afford the payments as long as the interest rate remains at 1%, then you're gambling.
Well, I agree that that's true. I agree that the banks clearly should not have extended these mortgages, and I said as much at the time. I thought they were insane. Right. That said, like, I can see – the thing is I can make an economic case for an option ARM. It's actually a good thing to have if you're sort of worried about the volatility of your income, right? That option's valuable. The problem is that people didn't use it as an option. They used it as the only way they could get a mortgage, and that was the real problem. Here's sort of my take on a lot of this. There's really interesting work by Vernon Smith's team at GMU.
Mm-hmm.
And I once asked one of the economists who work with him, do you guys do work in asset markets? And he said, yeah, we do. And the interesting thing is we get bubbles. Every time we have an asset market, we get bubbles. And the only way we stop getting bubbles is that people are in the market for a long time, if they've seen it two or three times, they start realizing when it's happening, and then it doesn't happen anymore. And I think one of the big problems on Wall Street is just that these guys are young.
Right.
And they haven't seen – I mean, we didn't have any bubbles basically from about sort of how you measure it – from about 1935 to about 1975, I think not so much because – the financial regulation was so good, but because people all remembered the Great Depression and they remembered it as the result of a speculative bubble, which is simplistic, but it doesn't matter. It affected how much people were willing to pay for stocks for a really long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what we're seeing now is a similar sort of thing. This memory is going to be searing for a very long time. So in some sense, I don't think we need to worry prospectively. The real question is there a way that we could have looked at this in 2004 as a regulator and stopped the bubble from taking off. And it's really not clear to me how you would have done that. It's always easy to regulate in hindsight. And if we could only get someone to like travel back from the future and do our financial regulations, that would be great. But I'm hard put to see how I expect a regulator to be very much smarter than the guys on Wall Street. Because remember, they really did think they were going to make money.
Right.
If they thought they were going to lose it, they wouldn't have bought it. And right. How does the regulator know more than they – I don't know.
Well, I mean, partly I think you told the story, right? It was not as if they had an option not to buy it. Even if they thought they were going to lose money in the long run, if they didn't, they were going to lose their job in the short run.
There's a definite herd mentality on Wall Street, and that's what you're seeing now, right? No one wants to buy because no one else is buying, and no one's going to buy right. until someone buys and shows them that it's all right to buy. Right.
But look, I could figure out in the summer of 2005 that at the then current price, I couldn't actually afford my house and sold it.
Right.
Now, you know, nobody's offering me a $1 million signing bonus to go to work for a hedge fund. So presumably the people they are offering that to are smarter than I am. So I'm puzzled about why they couldn't figure it out. I mean, people could not afford their houses.
Every time you get in, there's always a new theory. There's always a new theory about, like, I'm not in any way slamming Ed Glaser, who is a brilliant economist and really one of the most impressive economists of his generation. But his work provided this new theory that in the coast, because of zoning and because land was scarce, and I got this in my comments over and over and over again, they're not building new land.
Right.
And that animated a lot of belief that there was something special about coastal markets where you could just keep lending and it would just keep going up. And there's always a theory. And as Galbraith said, and I will drag this back and then we should probably move on. You know, he says every financial bubble consists of people discovering leverage and thinking that they have found some new magic formula for making money.
Right.
And that's exactly what happened here. And, you know, people just, they took on more risk and thought that they had actually found a way to make extra money, and they hadn't. And I think that I really don't know. I'm worried that we will, on the other side, decide right now that we want to put in a regulator who's just going to stop any of this from happening. And the fact is, America has like awesomely deep capital markets, and almost all of the time, that's a really good thing. So I think we want to be really, really careful about what sorts of things. I am much more a fan of the notion that when something blows up the way this did, and that what you do is you ease people out of the situation, you ease them out in such a way that it hurts them, in the same way that if someone like takes on a mortgage that they can't afford, right? I think that you want to ease them out by letting them declare bankruptcy and get out of it. But you also want to put a hit on their credit record because it should hurt. It shouldn't be painless to have something like this happen, even if you genuinely thought you could make the mortgage payment.
Right.
And I'm much more of a fan of that approach to regulation.
This is different from the theory that you hold and which I admire about why Silicon Valley works, which is that people are allowed to start up a firm, fail, lose everybody's money, and now they've got a credential to start up another firm because they failed once.
Yep. But I agree with that in the financial markets too. I think like if we come out of it, these guys will be much better traders. They will be much better investors. You know, so I think that, in fact, that's true here, too, which is why. But the Silicon Valley guys, it hurts, too. It hurts. They declare personal bankruptcy. It goes on their credit score. Bad things. Something bad should happen to you when you fail. The question is, what bad should happen to you? And I think that America is, in general, very good. And the people screaming for these guys' heads, actually, up and down the line, I think this about personal bankruptcy. I think this about, you know, people who took on mortgages. And I was saying this about the mortgages when my conservative commenters were screaming, you know, they borrowed the money, they ought to suffer, and all the way up to investment bankers. I think at every level, when people make mistakes, there should be consequences, but not fatal consequences.
Right. Well, at the moment, are we doing anything for the people who owe on their mortgages? I mean, it looks to me like we're helping the banks.
We're still there. There have now been some programs started up. They're pretty limited, and it's not clear to me how they work. I think Marty Feldstein actually. Other people hate the idea, but I think he actually had a pretty good idea, which is just that the government should make available to anyone a loan that basically takes that will take 20% of the value of your existing mortgage and give it to you as a loan. that's basically an arm pegged to the some sort of treasury bank note, treasury note rate. I'm not sure exactly what term treasury note he picked, but that I think would be a good way to let people who just got in a little over their heads. Some people just can't keep their houses. I mean, if you have no income and you bought a gigantic house, you can't stay in it. But for the people who just got in a little over their head and didn't quite understand what they were getting into, that would bring down their interest rate enough to let them sort of get back on their feet, build up a little equity, and stop the biggest losses in these markets where you now have sort of catastrophic cascades of foreclosures pushing prices down.
But what I'm worried about is that will help the prices stay at what's still above their real low. I mean, certainly,
I want them to fall, but I don't. But in some neighborhoods now, you've got situations where they're we do, I don't want them to undershoot, and there's danger in a lot of places that they will undershoot badly.
It seems to be what's happening at the moment. I mean, I can just speak for my own market, right? In the LA area, the cheap houses in remote locations are undershooting. You're getting developments abandoned half up, with people who own houses next to shells, and they're turning into instant slums. It reminds me of a great science fiction novel called The Space Merchants, which, among other things, tells a story about how a suburban development called Bel Rêve turns into a slum called Belly Rave. We're definitely seeing that in the high desert. But in the desirable parts of Los Angeles, in the sort of million-dollar price bracket, we're not seeing much in the way of decline. And so I think people are still imagining that since they're in the zone, they can't lose money in their house.
Yeah, you see a sort of similar phenomenon here in DC, where because people have government jobs and they tend to be fairly steady, there's not as many foreclosures around, and people put houses on the market at rates that are just clearly insane, and they're just not willing to come down. There are people who want to get sort of they think that they're really taking a haircut if they only get, say, 30,000 more than they paid for their house a year and a half ago. But I think that you can sort of you can deal with that problem by just limiting how much mortgage you'll cover, right? I mean, you can say,
So
look, we're
that's,
only going to.
but that wasn't part of the Feldstein problem. I mean, yeah,
No.
if you limit the houses under $500,000,
Right.
then you've got a different proposition. Actually, it'd be interesting. I've not seen a breakout of the problem loans by price of house.
Well, I think that you in California it's big. In New York, which is the other extreme market, it's not because in New York you can't like co-ops just won't let you buy unless you have like no co-op will let you buy in as far as I know unless it's really really shady will let you buy in without a 20% down payment and a lot of them will require 25 or 50. Some of them are even all cash. There are all cash buildings in New York where unless you can pay cash for your apartment, you're not allowed to buy there. And they also they look the co-op boards look at your financials and they won't if they think that they're too shaky, they won't let you buy. So the New York market is being buoyed by the fact that they're not having the same foreclosure situation. There aren't a lot of foreclosures there. In California, the high-end market, this is becoming a big problem, and also in Florida, where you've got sort of extremely expensive houses on the beach that the people living in them can't afford. I think that the part of the problem is that I think people are looking for sort of perfect solutions. And at some level, there's no cost-free solution to any of this. You can't have government regulation without slowing down markets that we want to develop. You can't and you can't have unregulation without risking things like this. And you can't, trying to titrate this ex so it's exactly perfect. I'm certainly happy to limit it to houses that are o under 500 million because 500,000 rather, because I just think that at some point, sell out, declare bankruptcy, go on with your upper middle class life.
But
But
actually, many of these mortgages are non-recourse, right? They don't have to declare bankruptcy. They just walk away from the house.
As far as I know, about 80% of the loans in the United States are non-recourse. But having a house foreclosed on is like a bomb on your credit report. I mean, I think it takes sort of 200 to 250 points off your FICO score. It's like as it, someone was telling me that it's worse than bankruptcy, which I don't think can be true, but it's extremely bad, and it lasts for 10 years. So people can walk away, but people really, and also people are emotionally attached to their houses. Marty Feldstein
right.
actually argued this in his op-ed, that there was going to be a real problem with people just deciding to leave these on the hands of the bank. I don't see that. People are not going to screw up their credit report, and they're not going to let their home go unless they really, really, really have
right.
no choice.
But of course, if they've got a credible threat to do that, and if a lot of people are doing that, then suddenly the banks should get to be more reasonable.
Well, I mean, actually, one of the big problems is it's not the banks. It's not clear.
Right, because
they're not
holding these things anymore.
And that's actually why what I think is the really good argument for some kind of federal intervention here is just that it's gotten to the point where it's unclear who you're supposed to renegotiate the terms of these loans with.
Right.
And that was, again, something that just wasn't anticipated on the kind of scale you're seeing.
Right. So let's. I mean, you said a couple of times what I think is true, that the regulators probably aren't any smarter than the guys at the banks. And it's entirely possible the regulators, on average, aren't as smart as the guys at the banks. Because after all, they're making between a tenth and a 40th as much money.
There's a tendency of the people who work at the SEC to do that so that they can go work for a law firm that works,
Right.
And
I mean, there's a general problem. I mean, the market for people who understand finance has been a very hot market, right? I mean, assistant professors, fresh PhDs in finance, who want to take academic jobs, right? Forget, want to take a job on Wall Street, start at above the pay of a top federal civil servant. And we've got a real problem that the federal government mostly can't afford the talent it needs. Or that is, federal government can afford the talent it needs for political reasons, we're not willing to pay
right.
Civil servants anything like what we pay people in the private sector. And it seems to me this is a huge problem that needs to get addressed.
I don't know how you address it. There will always be more money in evading regulations than there is in enforcing them.
There will always be more, right? But right now, say you had a federal civil servant in what used to be the traditional marriage where one spouse stays home,
mm-hmm.
right? They can't afford to send their kids to a good college.
Right.
Right? We could certainly pay our federal civil servants enough to live an upper middle class lifestyle.
I think in the areas that you're – unfortunately, they would have to live in New York. And I don't see civil servants getting paid more than the president of the United States is what it comes down to. To live in New York, you don't get a middle-class lifestyle on, $150,000 a year. You feel real poor. It's almost irrelevant in the sense that, there's just always going to be this invidious comparison. And this is why people in New York, which always sort of drives people outside of New York, and to be honest, me, a little insane, is that people in New York who make $500,000 a year will refer to themselves without irony as being upper middle class.
Right.
And part of that is just that the cost of living in New York is so high. And part of it
right.
is that you're always comparing yourself to these people who are just fabulously wealthy and you feel like you can barely make your school fees
and
the fee on your apartment.
Big political implications because journalists live in New York. A lot of journalists live in New York.
Yes.
Who was that idiot in one of the debates who said to one of the Democratic candidates, well, your tax plan would hit people who make $200,000 a year and, two professors married to each other make that.
I don't remember who it was, but it was certainly an object of much hilarity among my academic friends.
Right, I forget who's the ABC anchor man who died a couple of years ago.
Peter Jennings.
Yeah, left an estate of $50 million.
Yeah.
On his earnings as a TV quasi journalist.
Well, to be fair, not
well, life was
TV.
Different when journalists were poor.
I'm still poor.
Right.
The print.
But that's because you're actually a journalist.
The print people are still quite poor.
Right. But they're not the ones getting the big audience.
Yeah. We should move on to Elliot Spitzer, who would be financial regulator of all
right.
of these firms. You're a fan of his, I believe.
No, not at all. Not at all. I mean, I share the unholy joy that many people share. As a partisan, I think Patterson's probably a much better governor and much more likely to bring in a Democratic majority in the New York State Senate, which turns out to be an issue of national importance. partly because the Republicans in the New York State Senate are really horrible troglodytes who have, it's literally true that one of Bruno's central objectives as the majority leader of the New York State Senate has been to maintain the Rockefeller drug laws so that black people from Brooklyn will go to prison upstate where his constituents are, so they will have jobs as prison guards. Right? That's what it means to have a Republican majority in the New York State Senate. We're within now a seat of taking it back, or taking over for the first time in a long time. I think Patterson has a much better chance of getting those votes than Spitzer did. So I'm not at all distressed that he went down.
I'm second to none in my loathing for New York State politicians, but I should point out that this sort of thing is a bipartisan vice. I mean, Sheldon Sullivan managed to snatch an AMD factory that was supposed to revitalize upstate New York and got huge amounts of federal and state money and put it in the one area of New York that didn't need a new factory, which happens to be his district.
I don't doubt all politics do that.
Is terrible.
Right, but when the New York Senate Republicans do, you know, when their notion of a great pork barrel project for the district is a prison, and they therefore maintain laws that unnecessarily keep lots of people in prison for a long time as a result, I think that's more obnoxious than building the AMD factory in the wrong place.
I am more than happy to join you in bashing right. Bruno with as many words as I can gin up. Although I'm not actually confident. I think that many of his practices are vile, but I'm actually not very confident that uniparty rule is going to be good for New York State because the place already tilts really quite left.
Well, it'll be good. It'll be good for the country because it's
running all of it. What you end up with is that the activists get to decide in the primary sort of everything that happens, and it certainly has not been good for New York City to have this happen in the city council. Sort of one-party rule. So, I mean, in that sense, I'm a divided government fan in general, but I certainly will weep no particular tears for Joe Bruno.
Right, and if that works, of course, the Democrats get another 5 or 6 seats in the U.S. House, which I'm entirely in favor of. So Spitzer, we can agree that Spitzer was, you know, not in many ways an attractive character, and my view is that. Anybody who was prepared to pay $5,500 an hour for sexual services is not somebody I want in charge of my state government. Because obviously, if he put it out for bid, rather than letting a no-bid contract to a buddy, he could have gotten his tail much cheaper than that.
But it would have taken like 5 years. They'd still be doing the environmental impact statement.
It's true. However, all right, and as Attorney General, he decided to be the regulator of financial services markets and also of the corporate CEO pay market, which, as you said, wasn't exactly the job he was elected to do.
No.
But notice that it's precisely the conservatives who insisted, oh, we have a federal system and the federal government shouldn't get too reachy about this and we should leave regulation to the states. You know, insurance regulation is entirely a state matter. And so if it wasn't the job of the Attorney General of New York to worry about that stuff, then probably it was the job of somebody in the federal government to worry about that stuff. But no, we said it wasn't. So that was a state law matter.
What? No. No, he wasn't prosecuting under – like the SEC regulates the stuff that he was going after. The reason the SEC didn't make cases is, at least from what I can tell, because they couldn't. Because there wasn't a clear crime that they could go after people for. What Elliot Spitzer did was there's this thing in New York called the Martin Act. New York has a bunch of weird laws that were passed because New York was sort of the center of the progressive tradition. And it has a bunch of strange laws that got passed basically between 1910 and 1960, like the Taylor Act, like the Wick Act, and so forth. Which I'm sure you're familiar with. One of them is this thing called the Martin Act, which was aimed at fraud. And it was sort of little used when it was passed, and then attorney generals gradually expanded it, But the powers that it gives the Attorney General are unbelievably broad. They can interrogate potential defendants without recourse to an attorney, and also without the right against self-incrimination. So if you take the Fifth, you are presumptively assumed to have committed fraud. Also, you don't have to prove that
a
transaction took place, that anyone was defrauded, or that there was any intent to defraud. I mean, and when you're in that situation. And also the way that Elliot Spitzer did things, right, was he would put out rumors about an investigation, have these sort of targeted leaks that turned out in a lot of cases to be so misleading that if a journalist had done them, it would be libel. And would then watch the stock price tank. And because, as we're seeing with Bear Stearns, right, it's a credit-based industry. If your credit dries up, your company goes down. So they had to come to the table and negotiate whether they were guilty or not. And I'm not defending the idea that a lot of these guys were not doing vile things that they should have been punished for. And certainly if it wasn't illegal and we couldn't get them this time, we should have damn well made it illegal to do things like use your equity research to sell the – although even there I can make a case that this is a sort of a side effect of regulation. But that's neither here nor there. It certainly should have been, given the other laws, illegal to do this. The problem was that it's not clear that it was illegal to do it when they did it, and also that his tactics swept up the guilty along with the innocent.
Right.
And, by the way, sold out the investors. The money went to the state of New York. The people he was supposed to be going after, the investors, got nothing.
Right.
And when he ended his investigation, right, they not only got nothing, but he stopped sort of subpoenaing material that could have been used in a lawsuit by them. So overall, like, he was just a headline-grabbing, vile man who, as far as I can tell, did really very little to advance the cause of good, clean financial regulation in the United States.
So we have here a situation where you've got both corporate chief executives and boards and prosecutors given fairly enormous powers that are safe in their hands only if they have strong professional ethics. And it seems to me that both in the prosecution business and in the chief executive business, the ethics have been slipping, so that prosecutors are prepared to, I mean, it's not as if people like Dewey didn't do some of this same crap a long time ago.
Right.
But, you know, the lack of a distinction between right and wrong in powerful people is a problem. And as Madison said, you know, you can design institutions to try to make that hard, but in the end, no institution is adequate to overcome the frailties of the people who run it if they're frail enough. I think it was Popper who said that an institution is like a fortress. It needs to be both well-designed and properly manned.
Yes.
And I have a sense that the proper manning part of that has slipped in important ways. The prosecution misconduct under the Bush administration is purely a partisan issue, in the sense that, aside from some Republican state attorneys general who've spoken out on the Siegelman matter, the Republican Party has been in Congress has been perfectly happy to essentially say, well, I don't see anything wrong with this. The prosecutors serve at the president's pleasure. So partly what's happened is the Madisonian scheme, where institutional loyalties were going to keep, you know, provide checks, has fallen apart because the Republicans in Congress have been more loyal to the president than to their institution. And again, very hard to see how that gets undone.
Well, unfortunately, we're reliant on the goodwill of Democratic politicians who are pretty angry to undo it.
My pet dream is that President Obama will ask for the establishing of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Well,
because it's the only alternative to putting all of these guys in prison, which would probably not be the right thing to do.
I think that the issue is, yes, that people – I'm not sure that the issue is that boards have been given too much power per se. Or that the president has been given too much power per se. It's that we're supposed to be watching these people and we're not.
Right. Well, but also
the diversification, and the sense that, like, no one punished Bush for doing this. Almost no one knows. You and I know, right?
Right.
But almost no one does. No one pays attention.
Right.
And you and I are not enough to change this. And the real problem is that the people on the ground, and, you know, my question about the boards has long been, since the Enron scandals, where were the institutional investors? These guys are the guys who hold big chunks of money.
Right.
And they're the ones who basically, and they're the ones with the know-how. These guys should have been enforcing better standards on the boards, and they weren't.
Right.
And I still don't understand why they don't. They just sell out. If they think something's wrong, they sometimes because they're also customers or whatever, but they just sell out.
Well,
they
but
aren't
also the people,
activists.
other than the pension funds, the people who run the big institutional investors are drawing from the same salary pool that everybody else is. I mean, it's not in their interest to see CEO salaries go lower.
But you know, I'm not. CEO salaries are like somewhere around item 980 zillion on my list of worries about America. The issue isn't CEO pay. You know, if Ken Lay made $1 billion and Enron was still around employing people, it just wouldn't bother me that much. The issue
Right.
was that
The problem is that when people can make $1 billion as the CEO of a company, as long as the results look good, their incentive to cook the books to make the result look good gets to be pretty damned overwhelming.
Well, you know, I don't think that's fair because most CEOs, in fact, do not commit fraud. The overwhelming majority of them, despite the fact that they all have the same incentives, are honest. I think that there's a real problem, which is that people have this idea about financial regulation, which is that you can audit these firms, and
Right.
we just weren't auditing them well enough. And the fact is, they know the books better than you do.
Right,
So
right,
if they want to cheat you, they will.
right.
Because there's no, you know, an audit of the sort that people are imagining, where every single transaction gets checked, would involve having as many people as the ones who work at the company following
Right.
those people around. And then, you know,
Exactly.
what if you pay them off?
Right.
But the boards weren't doing oversight. I mean, a lot of the stuff that was going on, for example, at Enron, and you know, there's some stuff coming out now about. There may have been prosecutorial abuse on that. I don't know if you've seen this, that the
No.
prosecutors apparently conspired to withhold quite a lot of evidence from the
Right.
jury and exculpatory evidence from the jury and the defense
Right. But has
attorneys.
anybody gone after the board members? I mean, they all came out clean, right?
You know,
People are getting paid
in the sense that they're
$300,000
never
a
going to be on a
year.
board again, no.
Huh?
But the board members didn't. I mean, there was this. You know, are you really going to go after Lynn Cheney because she didn't understand accounting? It wasn't her fault. She shouldn't have been on the board.
Well, all right. So
And that
she
was
was
the
defrauding the
responsibility of.
stockholders by taking her $300,000 a year, essentially doing influence peddling, right? Presumably they had her on the board to buy her political influence.
Oh, I don't even think it's usually not that. They just want to have someone famous on the board. It's got, you know, it's just got to do with like I can say that Lynn Cheney
Famous and tame.
is on my board, but.
Right.
You know, and there may be some, but I think fairly minor. Because remember, you know, when she was put on the board, her husband wasn't vice president. You know, her husband was like a minor guy from whatever Cheney was doing before he was elected. I don't
He was
remember that
the
far
CEO
back,
of
but
Halliburton, and before that
yes.
he'd been the Secretary of Defense. I mean, he was a major league crony capitalist influence peddler.
But I don't think that they were buying her influence as much as they were buying just her name and.
Right.
And
My
whether or
question,
not they
my
were, I
question is,
mean,
should she have to give the $300,000 a year back to whoever the creditors were? She clearly didn't earn her director pay.
they
That's
well, the thing is, they can get sued, but they have insured. They like
right.
no one will go on a board unless you insure them against getting sued. And so, unless you can actually prove malfeasance, no, you can't take the money back. I would argue that maybe morally, she should give the money back because clearly she wasn't doing anything. But you know, unless you actually institute criminal penalties against the board, which I think would be way over the top. I mean, the real thing is, where were the institutional investors letting these boards be appointed? And they're still letting them be appointed.
Right,
Where are these
exactly.
people? Why isn't anyone taking responsibility for this? And this is to me the big problem facing capitalism right now. It's not that we don't have inadequate. It's not that we have inadequate financial regulation. It's not. The problem is that the diversification of markets has led to an erosion of responsibility
Right.
that is, you know, as we've diversified, that's good. But then we have to ask the question, how are people taking responsibility for this, for their jobs? And I think that it has to be them. You can't have the government deciding who's going to go on a corporate board. I don't think
It's
that would ever
basically a
fly in
public goods
America.
problem, right? So it's in the interest of all the shareholders, but not any one shareholder.
But it's in the interest of one shareholder. If you've got a big chunk of Alcoa, it is in your interest. Other people can free ride, but I don't
Right.
see that as such a gigantic cost.
Right.
I think it's more just that there's a culture of the diversification, the money managers don't think of them as themselves as responsible in the same way that owners do.
Right. All right. So free riding gets us to what I think should be our last topic.
Where we will
satisfy the bloggingheads.tv management by disagreeing vigorously.
Yes.
So can you state your, or maybe the right way to do this is for me to state what I think I heard you or read you to say.
Okay.
And you can tell me if it's not right. All right. So what you were saying is, look, all the liberals who support, well, all the prosperous liberals who support high taxes are really hypocritical. Because nobody wants high taxes on himself. Everybody just wants high taxes on somebody else. Is that a fair statement of your claim?
Not exactly.
All right.
It started off with a throwaway line. The state of Virginia had this tax me more fund that after 6 years closed because it only collected
nobody put any money. Because they weren't stupid.
And what I said was, this is what economists called revealed preference. People aren't really worried about taxes on themselves, because if they thought that the problem was that they had too much money, they would give it to charity. What they're really worried about is taxing other people. And I think that that's just positively true, right? Even if you posit a collective action thing, people are more focused on the money that they are going to get out of other people than they are focused on their own thing. But there was a second thing. So Henry Farrell then sidetracked that. So I stand by the positive claim 100%.
Let's pause on the positive claim.
Okay.
Right? Because I think it illustrates much less than you want it to illustrate. Right? So let's imagine a club. Okay? There are 1,000 members in the club, and we do a budget, and we decide to have club dues. Now, we could also have a tax me more fund for the club, where people can give money over and above their dues. And we notice that people are willing to vote for the dues and then pay them once they've been voted for. Mm-hmm. But that if we eliminated the dues and just let everybody contribute to the club, it would close down because not enough money had been contributed.
Right.
Now, that doesn't prove to me that people don't want club dues. Of course they want club dues. And they're willing to pay the club dues, given that everybody else will. They wouldn't be willing to make a voluntary contribution because they'd rather have the money in their pocket than in the pocket of the club.
Right.
What's
I'm not
the issue
disputing
here?
The existence of collective action problems,
right,
or even financial collective action
problems. So what does it show that people don't give to the Tax Me For More Fund, which would be really dumb to do? Since giving to the Tax Me For More Fund wouldn't actually increase the size of government programs, it is simply relieve taxes on other people.
Okay, so here is where we get into the positive argument for this. And I think that there are basically sort of, there's a bunch of different, the normative argument about this.
Right.
I think that the first thing that people said is, look, it's a collective action problem. I will only give if my tax dollars will buy X. My argument to that is that that's true at a club level where there is strategic. So they're basically saying, look, there's a strategic benefit to my withholding. I am withholding so that other people will have to pay in. And I feel that by withholding, I will get them to pay in. And at a small group level, that works. But
by the time you're up to
the level of the state government, there is no way that your behavior can strategically impact anyone else's behavior.
I agree entirely. People don't give to the Tax Me More Fund, not because they're trying to coerce other people to give to the Tax Me More Fund, but because they notice that if they gave it to the Tax Me More Fund, they wouldn't increase the size of the government. They'd merely be relieving the tax burden on other people, and they'd rather have the money in their pocket than in somebody else's pocket.
But I disagree with that, in fact. Again, your contribution is just too small even to relieve the tax burden on everyone else. It'll get netted up and poured into the...
Right. On the margin, my giving money to the Tax Me For More Fund at the federal level, let's say, is precisely equivalent to my burning $100 bills.
No. Now we go back to... because these are aggregate effects, right? In the same way that my refusing to eat meat probably doesn't result in any fewer dead chickens, because the number of chickens who are just discarded for spoilage is larger. You know, the number, sort of the error bar in the supply of chickens is just larger than my behavior is ever going to
impact as an individual. That can't be right. That can't be right. On average, once intelligent people running chicken companies and grocery stores have appropriately adjusted to the aggregate level of demand for chickens, the number of dead chickens is reduced on average by the number of chickens you don't eat.
I would disagree. I think that the number of the chicken market in the United States, the chicken market in Washington, D.C., if it were just me, if I were the only vegetarian in the city of Washington, D.C., the error bar on retail supply of food is just larger than anything, any detectable influence from my failure to eat chicken.
I didn't say you were reducing it detectively, but I'm saying
No.
on
What I'm saying is
average.
because they can't detect my lack of demand. That's what I'm saying. Demand
Right, but on.
fluctuates so much. Like a sale
Sure.
on steak will have more impact on demand than
Of
my
course.
refusal to eat chicken.
Of course, but assuming for the moment that a non-vegetarian eats 20 chickens a year to make up a number. And I don't know how many chickens are sold in the DC market, but many, many, many. We certainly couldn't detect a reduction of 20 chickens in that demand. But I would say if we ran the experiment a million times, so the sample size got big enough, what we discover is that if one person in that market doesn't eat 20 chickens, then 20 fewer chickens get sacrificed.
But I don't eat 20 chickens a year. Even, I mean, normal people
One
don't eat
chicken. I
20
mean,
chickens a year.
what is
No,
what?
but this is when the error bar, you're looking at it from this side, right? But the error bar from the other side, from the supply side, is just too large to detect any fluctuation in
Yeah,
demand from
sorry.
me.
I didn't say there was a detectable change. I just
But if they
said.
can't detect it, this is what I'm saying, right? They can't detect it. It's not that
Right.
I can't detect the impact, they
Sure.
can't detect my impact.
All right, but here's one way to think about it, right? You don't eat a chicken, right? As a result, one of two things happen. Either one more chicken goes to waste, right? Gets discarded because it was past its use by date, or one fewer chicken gets killed, right? That's just an accounting identity. The number of chickens killed is the number of chickens eaten plus the wastage, right? If you reduce the number of chickens eaten by one, and it's a surprise, then you might increase the wastage by one. But in the long run, if you reduce the number of chickens by one, you reduce the number of chickens killed by one. You shouldn't expect the wastage, and in fact, maybe by more than one, because for every chicken eaten, some fraction is also wasted.
Well, let me
Right?
put it this
So
way. Do you
yes, I
think
mean, the chicken you didn't eat didn't die.
that when if you leave a penny in your pants when you throw them out, does that decrease the U.S. money supply? At some
No,
level,
because
it's just not detectable. And
right, no, the money
because
supply.
it's not detectable, there's no response from the Fed. It's just it doesn't like at some level these things don't percolate. And I would argue that this is at that level. You paying an extra $500 to the state of Virginia is not going to have any impact on legislator behavior.
Right, it's not going to have any impact on anything. Right,
Well,
all it's going
no,
to do
that's not
is.
true. The $500 will be spent on something that if you are a big government liberal, you think the government should be doing.
No,
If you
wait a
think the
second. Listen.
government should be doing most of what it's doing, then you can give $500 to the government and it will do more of most of what it's doing,
Well, all
whatever
right.
that
Well,
is.
so two answers to that, right? One is, again, the accounting identity is that the spending minus taxes paid is the deficit. Okay? And you're saying if I contribute $500, it will reduce the, sorry, it will increase spending and not either reduce other people's taxes paid or reduce the deficit. And I have no reason to believe that. In
It
fact,
will reduce the deficit.
if you contribute money to the federal government, it specifically goes to reduce the deficit. That's by statute. Right? And so all that does is reduce future tax liabilities, right? As you and I agree, the debt is future tax liability.
I agree that that's true in aggregate, but I agree, but at the margin, any one person's behavior just doesn't have any impact on anyone else's behavior.
Right.
You've got a
And
group of a million people to do this, and to the extent that you think that you have too much money, don't send it to the government. To the extent that you think that you have too much money and people like you should have lower incomes, then you should give that extra money to charity, whether or not anyone else
Right.
does.
Right, exactly. No,
That was the
right.
point I was making, is that there is a
Right. And
normative
but
question.
notice the
If
by
you
the
think that
very
there is a
same
justice question about your income, then there is a norm, then I think you have a normative obligation to give that money away, whether or not anyone else does. And I
Right. So
think the problem is that
this
they
is the Peter
violate
Singer
fairness
argument.
sense.
This is the Peter Singer argument, right? That nobody should live above subsistence when people are starving in the world.
Nobody should live above what they think it is just for them to have, given the state of other people in the world.
Right. And yeah, in a world of perfect Kantian actors, there'd be no need for government. Well, we knew that. But it's perfectly rational for me not to make voluntary contributions to the federal government, but instead to make contributions to the political candidates who will bring around tax
Sure.
laws that will actually bring about the results I want in the world. And the fact that we have to have taxes rather than doing it voluntarily is no more an argument that taxes are a bad idea than the fact that you have to have dues at the club is an argument the club's a bad idea.
But I didn't make an argument against having taxes. This is the thing, is like,
Right. So
when you
what
say
is the
something,
argument?
not every argument is instrumental. Sometimes things are just about the thing. It wasn't an instrumental argument about how society shouldn't have taxes. I think society should have taxes. I think there are real
Right.
free rider problems, there are real collective action problems,
Right.
and you need taxes to pay for them.
Right.
We're
So
100% in agreement on that. We probably disagree about what the collective action problems are and how big they are and what constitutes a public good.
Right.
But this wasn't an argument against taxes per se, or even about the level of taxes. It was just saying that, like, when people agitate for taxes, what they are agitating for is for other people to pay taxes.
Right,
If
well,
they
so
thought
let,
that the problem was their own income, they can take care of that right now.
right, well, but let me put it in a different context, right? People agitate for criminal laws, right? For example, for a law against homicide. Now, you might say, well, look, I'm not in favor of a law against homicide that applies to me. If there's somebody I shouldn't kill them even if there's no law against it. Right? So the only reason I'm voting for a homicide law is to keep you from killing somebody.
Yes, I agree that that's true. Almost all laws that people vote for are about someone else's behavior. Almost no one ever votes for any law that to stop themselves from doing something they know they shouldn't.
Right. So that's merely the point that, you know, putting aside issues of imperfect self-command, you can't make somebody's behavior better or somebody's welfare better by limiting his options. Right? I mean, that's sort of elementary. Right? So yes, always it's the case that when I vote for compulsion, I'm voting to compel other people and merely willing to accept compelling myself as one of the side effects.
But
and that's
see, I
true.
think that that has moral weight in and of itself and
Okay,
should
but
dictate how we think about should dictate how we think about the laws that we agitate for, because
So
we're
what is the
always
moral weight?
agitating for things to stop other people from doing something and
Such
never
as
agitating
homicide.
for things to stop ourselves from doing something. And I think that that is it is actually important then to examine whether you would feel the same way whether you feel the same way when it's your neighbors trying to stop you from doing something.
Well, but see, since I'm voting for a law that in fact stops me from doing something as one of its effects, then I say, no, I'm doing a perfectly reasonable thing. I'm saying everybody should not kill other people, and everybody who's got a lot of money should pay a bunch of it in taxes, both to help people who don't have a lot of stuff and to get our collective purposes done. So I don't see what the moral problem is there at all.
You know, it's a judgment call. I think that your political beliefs have moral weight and that you should think about them. But it's not, you know, it doesn't have to be that if you say, like, you should think hard about, you know, what you're trying to accomplish with this, is to say that you shouldn't be in favor of the law. It's just to say that you should think hard about it. And I think that most of us don't
well,
think
if you're making
hard
if you're
enough
making as a positive
about
claim, if you're making as a positive claim that people only prefer taxes on other people, right? That nobody would favor a tax increase that would hit him. Well, that's not true. I mean, lots of prosperous liberals want higher taxes on people like them.
Right. But I didn't say that wasn't true. I just said that they were primarily interested in getting other people to pay taxes, not in raising their own taxes.
Yeah, right.
I mean, like, I actually, the problem is that I think that liberals don't think that I actually think this is an interesting question, when in fact, I really am obsessed with the question of how much it's fair for me to consume. I mean, like, I worry about that. As a part of my own life.
Right.
And so when I'm saying things like this, it's not just to sort of, you know, get liberals and
right.
you know, slap them down for being stupid. I think about how much, you know, I think that other people should think about it too, because I think it's an important question. But I think about these things and
right.
I think about how much of my income I should have to give away, et cetera. So this isn't
well,
sort of coming out of left field.
Think about how generous liberals like me are. We're helping to make that problem easier for you. Helping to relieve your conscience. And it seems to me on that benevolent note,
We
should
yes,
probably wind this
we
up.
should ease we should ease the burden on our watchers by stopping the
Exactly.
tape.
Exactly. It's
But it's been
always a
great
great
talking to you.
pleasure. Thanks. Take
And
care.
hope we'll talk soon.
Soon.
Bye bye.